of the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Another shooting, this time at Saugus High in Santa Clarita. We'll hear how folks in Saugus are dealing with this tragedy and how parents can help their children process it all. Plus, an update on whether California will still require new homes to have rooftop solar panels. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. We start today in Santa Clarita, where unfortunately an all-too-familiar scene took place at a local high school. Here's L.A. County Sheriff Alex Villanueva describing what happened.
At 7:38 this morning, Santa Clarita Sheriff's Station received a 911 call of a shooting at Saugus High School. Within seconds, we received multiple calls, and within 2 minutes, at 7:40, our first units arrived on scene.
Six students were shot at Saugus High School. Two of them have died. They were 14 and 16. Here's Sheriff Villanueva again.
I hate to have Saugus be added to the names of Columbine, Parkland, Sandy Hook, but it's a reality that affects us all throughout the nation, something we're going to have to deal with. And we got to figure out, what are we doing wrong and how can we stop this from happening in the future?
KPCC's education reporter Kyle Stokes has been in Santa Clarita all morning talking to students and their parents. Kyle, welcome.
Hi.
You were at the reunification area where parents were supposed to meet up with their children. Where was that and what was that scene like this morning?
So that was at Central Park, which is a large park with a lot of soccer fields and wide open spaces just down the road from Saugus High School. And if you can sort of picture the scene here, there was this kind of this road that went through a big field, kind of a road that connected the parking lots there. The buses of students that were being evacuated from the school brought to this reunification center would come down this road and be released to a field, let's just say, on the left side of the road. On the right side, there were parents standing on the curb, right up to the curb, hundreds of parents this morning waiting to be reunited with their students. It was quite the process to get the students reunited with their parents. Students lining up on the other side of this road. We're told that the sheriff's department was interviewing almost every single one, and certainly every student had to sort of sign out and be accounted for by school personnel before being reunited with their parents. So it was a sort of long process of reunification and obviously some frustration about the sort of amount of time that it took. But the process was very orderly, even though it was quite tense.
Well, that's good to hear. And parents, I'm sure, very anxious waiting for their kids to arrive. What stood out to you when you spoke to moms and dads?
Well, so the thing that just really stood out to me was about how many of the students and parents expressed knowing exactly what to do in these sorts of situations. We hear so much about trying to find ways to barricade yourselves and shout shelter in place. And a lot of the students that I spoke to described doing exactly that. One junior that I talked to described barricading herself using a computer cart into her forensic science classroom. Another student I heard tell his dad told me that he grabbed a fire extinguisher from outside the classroom, brought it into the classroom to use as a potential weapon, piled desks against the door, told his dad, I'm turning off my cell phone. I don't want my ringer to go off. He handed out textbooks to try and put just something between his classmates and the potential shooter. So it sounds like a lot of students knew how to protect themselves, though at the same time, they said, we never expected this kind of thing to happen here. It's just clear that they knew what to do once it did.
Now, you spoke to students. Here's one of them, Brooke Risley, who's a junior at Saugus High.
Everyone says, like, you never think it would happen to you. Genuinely think, if I was at this place right now, like, where would I go if there was a shooter on campus? Because I know I will. Like, everyone at Saugus is going to be changed from this.
Kyle, school shootings are rare, but they are happening with far more frequency. Listening to Burke right there, and it sounds like she will from now on always be prepared for one no matter what happens. And you mentioned how kids know what to do, and it kind of breaks your heart. It's good, right? But it breaks your heart to know that kids know what to do when it comes to shootings. Did you hear similar things from other students having this kind of threat on their minds constantly?
Well, I mean, and I think it's the sort of duality of we think that this is a safe school, a safe neighborhood, a safe area, and also sort of knowing that there's this broader national trend. I mean, some statistics say that this was the 38th shooting at elementary or secondary school this year. That's according to the Gun Violence Archive. And I think that there is this sort of dual feeling. It's like we know that there's this broader context, this broader story here. But we just never think that it's going to happen at your school. And, you know, as you say, 38, compared to the thousands of schools that are out there, it's still relatively rare. But we hear these headlines so commonly, and the stories of people walking out of these classrooms when these other shootings happen, it's hard to believe that, you know, not only between active shooter drills and preparation like that, lockdown drills and so forth, between that and, hearing from other students who've been in similar circumstances on the news, that these students didn't take away some lessons from hearing these other stories.
Now, the shooter, as we all understand it, is currently in critical condition in the hospital after shooting himself. What else do we know about him and why he may have even done this?
We don't really know much. Authorities have only confirmed that this is a 16-year-old male, and the sort of remarkable detail that you don't normally hear at a press conference like this is that today was his 16th birthday. So I think for some people, that's going to be identifying information, because there are certainly students who are circulating rumors about who this, about who the alleged shooter is. But we also know that there is surveillance video, according to sheriff's investigators, of this act, of this this incident taking place, of a male shooter taking a 45 caliber semi-automatic handgun out of his backpack, opening fire and striking five of his classmates.
One more thing, Kyle. I understand that there have been threats made to this school recently, actually. Do we know if there's any connection at all?
No, there is no connection at all. The sheriff's investigators have said that there are two related threats that have been made in relation to the school in the past, and that there is no nexus between this shooter, this alleged shooter, and those prior threats.
That's KPCC's Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And we'll be keeping you up to date on this story all afternoon long. School shootings are rare occurrences, but they've made headlines too many times in recent years. This morning's incident at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita left two students aged 14 and 16 dead. Four other students, including the suspect, are being hospitalized. And all this begs the question, again, of how to process it and how to talk to your children and other young people about what happened. Kathy Payne is a school psychologist based in Oregon. She's with us now to talk about how to help children deal with trauma associated with incidents just like these. Kathy, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Kathy, let's start with Saugus High School. If you're a parent of a student at Saugus High School, how should you be talking to your child today? How can you help them? What should be the first thing you say?
Well, the first thing we'd want to do, of course, is give our kids a big hug and tell them we love them, and reassure them that they are safe. Have a conversation with them, ask them how they're feeling, ask them what it was like. We want to find out what their experience was in the moment at the school.
What kind of signs, Kathy, should we be looking for if maybe your kid just doesn't want to talk right now or is maybe trying to pretend like it's not a big deal, but deep down they're really just freaked out?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been doing this work with schools that have had school violence for about 20 years now. And one thing to know is that not everyone reacts in the same way. And some students may react overtly. So they might get very emotional. They might have trouble sleeping. They might have trouble eating. And other students might react more quietly and just not want to talk about it. And that's okay. All of those things are fine. We want to take the student where they are and just help them in the way that they want to be helped. So sometimes art, drawing is helpful. Sometimes talking is helpful. Some students might be ready to go back to school and back to work, you know, in a few days. Others, it's going to take weeks or months or years.
Talking to Kathy Payne, school psychologist based in Oregon. Now, the thing about this, let's just say a kid is in another community, say 30 miles away. How do you discuss this with your kid if they maybe have questions about what happened?
Yeah, it's really important that we do have conversations about this with our children, even if we're across the country. Even though this happened in one school in California, we all know that it can happen in any school. And it's really important to deal with those feelings of fear that it might happen, and also reassuring students that, you know, these shootings are actually very rare, even though when you're in it, of course, it doesn't seem very rare at all. But it's been calculated there's about a 1 in 2.5 million chance of being in a victim of the school shootings. I would encourage parents to talk to their schools about what measures they are taking to provide safety.
Should parents monitor or try to see how their kid gets their information or their news about the events?
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, it's harder with the older students, you know, are going to have more freedom to have their devices. We also want to limit watching the TV coverage for the students. Even though we know that they're playing the same footage over and over again, the young students often think that it's happening again because they're seeing it again.
You know, Kathy, I remember growing up as a kid in LA, the only drills we did were earthquake drills or fire drills. Active shooter trainings are almost as common now in schools. Do you get a sense that this weighs on kids more these days?
You know, I think it does. And I've certainly heard interviews with students that say have said that. One of the things that I do in my profession is to help schools develop lessons on active shooter drills that are appropriate to their grade level. What it does is it puts that potential reality in front of us. So it's really important that the schools do them appropriately and that they take into account the possible emotional trauma that can come from just doing the drills.
Is there any particular language to use that maybe won't scare them? Because it's a delicate balance, right? I mean, you want them to be aware, but you know, you don't want to overwhelm them and frighten them either.
Right, right. With elementary students, what we found to be most successful is to talk to them about an idea called stranger danger. That's something that usually our parents have already talked to them about as preschoolers, and so we just transfer that into the school and talk about the fact that there might be a stranger in our school that's a dangerous person, and if that happens, here's what we're going to do. With high school students and middle school students, we can have the conversation a little more about what the danger might be.
Yeah, because what if you have a situation in a school where it's not a stranger, it's a peer, it's a friend of yours, or it's some kid that you know in your English class, right? That's a completely different dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the conversation we have to have with middle and high schoolers, because the interesting thing is that as we study these school shootings, the elementary school shootings are generally the perpetrator is an adult who comes in from the community. Whereas with middle and high school students, it's much more likely to be a student or a former student.
Kathy Payne is a school psychologist based in Oregon. Kathy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, coming up later on the show, we'll have more coverage of the Saugus High School shooting. But moving on for now, next few weeks on KPCC, you'll hear familiar voices reading the amendments to the Constitution. LeVar Burton will read the amendment that ended slavery, while Danny Trejo reads the rights guaranteed for those accused of crimes. Plus, there's Shepard Fairey, Aubrey Plaza, Norman Lear, many, many more. It's all part of the nationwide Purple Project for Democracy, a nonpartisan campaign to recommit to democratic values and institutions.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson. This public radio station is celebrating American democracy by presenting the amendments to the U.S. Constitution that lay out our freedoms and how democracy works. The 24th Amendment, ratified in 1964, made it illegal to make anyone pay a tax to have the right to vote. The right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representative in Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax. I was always taught as an African American kid growing up that there are certain rights that we have that are extremely important to always make use of, and voting was one of the big ones. This idea that someone might make you have to take a test or pay a tax in order for you to exercise a right is just abominable. And the fact that we had to fight so hard for it is one thing. But the idea that we would fight so hard for it and then not use it every single time, all the time, is almost criminal. that's something that a lot of people fought for and died for.
That was Public Radio's Joshua Johnson, host of 1A, reading the 24th Amendment. It's part of the nationwide Purple Project for Democracy, a nonpartisan campaign to recommit to democratic values and institutions. Nonprofit organizations typically are dedicated to a specific mission or cause, and while for many of the employees of a nonprofit, their work is a labor of love, it's still work that they rely on to pay their bills. So when a nonprofit shuts down because the boss maybe mismanaged money or used it for their own expenses, it can have far-reaching consequences. Coming up in 60 seconds, how an LA bankruptcy of a nonprofit fits that bill to a T. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The nonprofit Youth Policy Institute provided services such as after-school programs for years to families in need all across Los Angeles. But it abruptly shut down last month, eliminating hundreds of jobs after an internal audit found that funds had been grossly mismanaged. Bankruptcy filings lodged last week show that former CEO Dixon Slingerland had used the nonprofit's money on personal expenses going back to 2014. In a few minutes, we'll be talking to someone who specializes in nonprofit law. But for more on YPI, we start with LA Times reporter David Zonister.
Well, this was a group with a $47 million budget, and they really were an anti-poverty organization. So they did after-school programs and tutoring and college prep and tax preparation and job training. And they were really focused sort of in two areas, Hollywood and the neighborhoods that surround it all the way to Pico Union, and then Pacoima, and then spreading into other neighborhoods in the San Fernando Valley. They've been around for about 25 years, give or take.
The nonprofit has some ties to some pretty big names, Mayor Eric Garcetti, President Barack Obama. What can you tell us about those relationships?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, in addition to being just one of the city's kind of bigger nonprofits, they were very politically connected. Dixon Slingerland, the CEO until September, he raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for President Barack Obama and signed some of his fundraising emails as an Obama victory trustee, which meant he was basically raising quite a bit of money for Democratic Party candidates. Locally in L.A., he co-hosted at least seven of the fundraisers that were held by Eric Garcetti when he ran for mayor in 2013. And the attention really flowed both directions. I mean, the Obama administration was very good to Youth Policy Institute, providing them, you know, tens of millions of dollars in grants and grant commitments. And Garcetti was a fixture at their events. He was at their yearly gala. He did press conferences to promote the money they brought in. His very first day as mayor, he actually cut a promotional video encouraging people to support Youth Policy Institute. So this was a connected guy.
The bankruptcy filing says Slingerland is on the hook for $1.7 million after spending company money on personal expenses. What exactly was he buying?
Well, they didn't itemize it individually, but they definitely identified what they considered to be spending of nonprofit money on personal items. So they said, for example, he used nonprofit funds to pay his property taxes, that he used their money to pay for his kids' tutoring. He made political contributions, which is definitely a no-no under IRS rules. He ordered furniture for his home office, according to the bankruptcy filing.
What has he said, Dixon Slingerland? What has he said about this?
Well, he said that he considered many of the allegations to be incorrect or, in his words, quote unquote, extremely misleading. He said he's tried to resolve these issues with the nonprofit repeatedly. And he also says that Youth Policy Institute owes him money, although so far we've not been provided any details. He did acknowledge that he made some personal payments with the company credit card, and a representative said that that included the property tax bill, the tutoring, and at least some political contributions to federal campaign committees.
All right, now, like most nonprofits, Youth Policy Institute has a board of directors. What role did they play in governing the organization?
The bankruptcy filing spells out sort of a chronology, a timeline of the problems that they identified. So in July, they brought in a new guy named Dan Grunfeld to head the board. And in September, the board fired Dixon Slingerland after 23 years, and they made Dan Grunfeld the new CEO. And he was really in a triage kind of situation, I think, at that point. And as recently as last month, people were talking like they still thought they could find a way to make the group survive, but it did not happen that way.
All right, now let's turn to Erin Bredrick. She's a principal attorney with the Neal Law Group, specializing in nonprofit law. Erin, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
The mission of a nonprofit board of directors, what is that? And what level of involvement would you expect them to have in a company of this size?
So the role of the board is usually defined by state law, and they fundamentally boil down to three main duties. It's the duty of care, the duty of loyalty, and the duty of obedience. So for an organization of this size, I would expect significant delegation of authority for the day-to-day operations down to a CEO who then typically has oversight over other officers and employees of the organization.
Would a nonprofit board of directors, Erin, know when money is being spent or moved around?
So a big key role of the board is to ensure it understands and is monitoring the financial health of the organization. Certainly a best practice for boards to be reviewing financial statements on a regular basis, but certainly once the board becomes aware, they definitely have a duty to take steps to properly address anything that they are made aware of in terms of improprieties. I'm not sure exactly how that played out here, but it does sound like the board formed a committee to try to address some of the issues that were raised in that audit. Of course, if they had knowledge earlier and didn't take action, that could potentially be problematic. But I will say that personal liability of volunteer directors of nonprofits is very rare, absent egregious circumstances.
Talking about the sudden closure and bankruptcy of the nonprofit Youth Policy Institute here in Los Angeles with attorney Erin Bredrick and LA Times reporter David Zonisser. David, have you been able to talk to the board members at all? Or have any maybe former staffers said anything to you about the situation?
Once they filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, everyone stopped communicating and said they can no longer really broach it. But the former employees are definitely talking, and they're very unhappy. I mean, not only did they lose their jobs with 24 hours notice, but they didn't get their last week's pay, they didn't get their accrued vacation. And frankly, you know, I've talked to a number of them who said that they were very proud of the programs that they provided, and now they're very concerned that some of those aren't going to happen anymore.
Erin, the CEO, Dixon Slingerland, what are the legal consequences that he might be facing? We heard earlier that he admitted to some personal charges, but said it was just a mistake and a misunderstanding.
If somebody commits embezzlement or fraud, and I'm not necessarily saying that's what occurred here, but if it is, there's a duty for the funds to be returned, but that then there's also a 25% penalty tax that is imposed on the person who received the benefit, so the CEO here. And if it's not reported and corrected in time, a second 200% tax can also be imposed. So potentially huge financial implications for the CEO. And then, of course, if there was criminal activity, there can also potentially be criminal charges that are brought.
David, where does this story go from here?
Well, I think in the most immediate sense, you know, is the question about what happens to the remainder of the programs and the workers. You know, they've been doing these sort of job fairs for the remaining employees who haven't found spots at other nonprofit groups. I think it's still an open question about whether certain programs like tutoring will transfer at all.
LA Times reporter David Zonisser and attorney Erin Bredrick discussing some of the details around the sudden closure and bankruptcy of the nonprofit Youth Policy Institute in LA. David, Erin, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right, now to the military. A recent report found that the military often mishandles domestic violence on base, leading to fewer prosecutions and more danger for people who are abused. Some abused spouses say they're just not taken seriously and the process favors the abuser. Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
Elise Monroe remembers her ex-husband's anger, quick, explosive, and loud.
He liked to punch things. One night when he was drunk and angry, he punched a hole in our shower. It was always my fault. If he was angry, it was something I did.
But Monroe says the first time she felt fear was in January 2010, a few months after she, her husband, and their two young children moved on base at Fort Drum, New York.
And I remember that night I had tried to lock myself in our bedroom and he kicked it open and cornered me. And I had tripped and fallen and he grabbed me really hard on the arm and picked me up.
When military police showed up, they noted the torn apart house and the bruises that had started to bloom on Monroe's arms. They took her husband away for a 72-hour cool down period and sent Monroe to have her injuries photographed at a base medical facility. But while the Army punished Monroe's husband for damaging their house, he was never prosecuted for hurting her. Instead, his command ordered him to go to anger management counseling. Monroe says no one followed up about her well-being.
No one offered me services. No one told me that there were things that were there for me, for my benefit, for my children's benefit. In my opinion, it was solely concentrated on him.
Monroe's situation is not unique. Earlier this year, the Defense Department Inspector General found that the military often mishandles domestic violence. It said military police sometimes were sloppy with evidence collection and interviewing, and often failed to report offenses into federal databases as required. The Inspector General also found that police often didn't tell abused spouses about family advocacy, a Defense Department program which offers them support and safety counseling. Lisa Colella directs Healing Household 6, a military family organization.
You know, certainly people come to me and they show me evidence that they have reported in the way that they're supposed to. And there have been more times than I can count that the family advocacy representative told me that they didn't have any file on this person.
The report also found commanders sometimes interfered at crime scenes, pushing law enforcement to do things that weren't in keeping with protocol. And Colella says an abuser's command sits on the committee that decides what's actually violence.
It's just this giant, like, jumbled mess of reputations and culture and who's the service member and how many medals do they have and what have they done and was this really abuse?
Since the IG report was released in April, Colella says she's seen signs that some bases have begun to take their domestic violence protocols more seriously, though the response has been inconsistent. Another change happened last year when Congress amended the military's criminal code to include domestic violence. Brian Klubb of the Battered Women's Justice Project says that may be encouraging enforcement.
What Congress directed was that now, with the specific domestic violence and domestic assault offense, it would be easier to track these offenses within the military justice system, be able to report on them, as well as to be able to flag them correctly for civilian law enforcement.
But for domestic abuse survivor Elise Monroe, change didn't come fast enough. Her ex-husband's violence continued to escalate until 2016, when, after leaving the service, he threatened her life.
There was a moment where he had me on the front step with his knee in my side, and he had punched me in the face and said that if I was not quiet, he was going to put me in the ground where I belonged. I knew he had a loaded weapon in his truck.
Monroe fled with her kids to safety and is now remarried. Her ex-husband continued to spiral. Last year, he was shot by a guard at the Department of Veterans Affairs after he threatened the guard with a knife. He survived the shooting but was convicted of several crimes. Monroe can't help but wonder if that all could have been prevented if the military had taken her abuse more seriously. This is Carson Frame reporting.
All right, now to an update from yesterday. The California Energy Commission has declined to vote on a program to provide off-site solar energy for new housing in Sacramento. The proposal would offer an alternative to the state mandate for all new homes to include rooftop solar panels starting in 2020. Critics say off-site solar would essentially nullify that requirement. LA Times Energy reporter Sammy Roth has been covering the story.
So there was a really robust debate at the Energy Commission yesterday. Dozens and dozens of people showed up to provide public comments, most of them against this proposal for off-site solar. You had environmental activists and people who work for rooftop solar companies and ratepayers of the Sacramento utility, all sort of coming forward and arguing that they thought this wasn't really what was intended by the state of California when they passed this rooftop solar mandate last year. You had a little bit of support for the proposal, too, from folks who work in the building industry, but they were really outnumbered over several hours of public comment. And ultimately, what happened is that the commissioners were skeptical. You had commissioners who were questioning the economic value that this program would provide to new homeowners. And at the end of the day, it just became clear that there weren't the votes to actually pass this yesterday. So the commissioner who was sort of in charge of this and in favor of the off-site proposal proposed delaying while they try to figure out a solution.
The commission is planning to better define community solar, but a timeline for a vote has not been set yet. We're going to check back in on the shooting at Saugus High School and hear what the scene at the hospital where the victims are is like right now. Also, the number of California trees infected with a deadly disease has nearly doubled since last year. It's called sudden oak death, and it's spreading really, really fast. Coming up, we'll hear why and about the team of volunteers who actually went out in the forest and helped diagnose all those oak trees. That's coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. We've been bringing you news about the shooting at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita. Six students were shot this morning, including the shooter. KPCC's Robert Garova has been reporting from Henry Mayo Newhall Hospital in Santa Clarita, where four victims were taken. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, A.
All right, some good news, it sounds like. One patient has been discharged.
Yeah, that's the latest within the last hour or so. A male who was brought here in good condition was discharged, was sent home. Of the four patients that were brought here this morning, two died, one male and one female. There's a male still in critical condition.
Is there anything that we know about the two that that died, or the remaining patient who's still there? Anything else?
We don't know anything yet. The hospital has said that, you know, what they're hearing from police and officials is, you know, definitely not to release anything. Investigations are ongoing, and you know, parents need to be notified and that sort of thing.
Do we know if the remaining patient is the shooter himself?
They won't say anything about that either, because of the things I just cited. You know, the sheriffs really don't want them to say anything yet.
Robert, how's the hospital staff holding up? Do you have a sense, that they were ready for a situation like this? I mean, who could possibly be ready for something like this?
Right. Well, you know, they did say that, you know, they did feel like they were ready.
Okay.
They had done drills for circumstances like this felt like they were prepared for, you know, a terrible day like today and that, you know, they did the best they could under the circumstances.
How does it look like they're holding up emotionally through this?
Well, you know, I will tell you, I haven't talked to any doctors. They've promised some medical staff at some point.
Okay.
I will tell you that there is a very hardworking public information officer here who has been keeping everybody up to date. And he is, his phone has been blown up all day. So
all right.
I feel for him.
KPCC's Robert Garova. He's been reporting from Henry Mayo Newhall Hospital in Santa Clarita about the school shooting at Saugus High School. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Southern California Edison has agreed to pay $360 million to local governments over two wildfires sparked by its equipment. The money will go toward reimbursing cities and counties for what FEMA did not cover, including damaged roads and infrastructure and also firefighting costs. The California Report's Larry Buell has more.
Local governments in Southern California sued SoCal Edison over damages from the deadly Thomas and Woolsey fires. Last year's Woolsey fire started near Los Angeles and quickly spread to the ocean. The Thomas fire started in Ventura County in 2017. Investigators said it was sparked by utility wires slapping together in a windstorm. That fire later caused a mudslide in Montecito. The $360 million will be split among five cities in Santa Barbara, Ventura, and Los Angeles counties.
We feel it's a fair settlement.
Felicia Liberman is assistant city attorney for the city of Thousand Oaks. She said the fire cost the city a lot of money.
Staff time to respond to the emergency effort, structural damage, damage with respect to ecological resources and land.
The payout doesn't include private lawsuits over deaths or homes destroyed. Edison did not admit wrongdoing or liability in the settlement. I'm Larry Buell in Los Angeles.
All All right, now to the woods. A disease that has killed over 50 million species of oak trees in California over the past two decades is now on the rise. That's according to a recent survey by UC Berkeley scientists that study the condition known as sudden oak death. Researchers found that the number of infected trees has nearly doubled since 2018, and in some areas, the rates increased as much as 10 times compared to last year. For more on the pathogen and its impact on the state, we turn now to Mateo Garbalato, director of the UC Berkeley Forest Pathology and Mycology Laboratory.
Hello.
Now, before we get into the rise and rapid spread of the tree disease, can you give us a brief explainer of sudden oak death? It sounds terrible. What is it, and how did it get here?
It is, in fact, terrible. It's an exotic disease that is caused by a tiny microbe that was brought to California on infected ornamental plants, probably in the early to mid-80s. And so I'm talking about plants like rhododendrons or camellias. Pieris is another one. These are plant species that are fairly common in our gardens. And for many years, until we discovered this organism, these plants were being sold on the market carrying this little microbe inside of them that then would come out of these plants and infect native plants that were growing nearby. And since then, it's been moving freely in coastal forests, infecting almost every single tree species that grows in such forests, but particularly aggressively killing three oak species and the related tan oak.
Now, you've been leading the research on sudden oak death for the past 12 years. What are the most recent findings, and how do those findings compare to previous years?
Yes, because this is an invasive organism, we really are tracking its invasion every year, because every year the area that's covered by this organism changes a little bit. And so we really need to keep track of where the organism has arrived. And so every year we run a survey. And the unique thing about this survey is that most of it, if not all of it, is run by volunteers. Hmm. So as a result of the 2019 survey, now we know that the disease has really increased sharply compared to last year. I would say that it's about double this year, but in some area it really spiked, you know, sometimes 5 or 10 times higher than last year. I would say that's an indication that the organism is thriving, is doing really well, which is obviously not a good thing.
Right.
And I must say that the most striking result was the fact that we have a large number of outbreaks all over, you know, the coast of California. And it's almost like any area where the pathogen has been before or previously, now it's flaring up at the same time simultaneously.
What impact does this have on our forests, on the environment? What consequences can come of sudden oak death spreading the way it has been?
Well, it has a huge impact because it's taking away one or more tree species that we usually define as keystones. So they are the trees upon which most of the life in these forest ecosystems depends on. And so a lot of the bird species are disappearing from our forest. They use these tree species. A lot of the mushrooms that grow, a lot of the smaller mammals and animals, they inhabit the trunks of these trees are disappearing. Mm-hmm. And some of the other plants that normally grow together with oaks and tan oaks are also disappearing, or they're not as comfortable anymore because they're missing the main cover that these oaks provide for them.
Does one of these oaks that's afflicted with sudden oak death, do they become better fuel for wildfires?
When you have oaks and tan oaks that are dead, standing because of sudden oak death, those trees will ignite very easily and they will burn very, very hot. This effect that makes fires so much more dangerous and hot has a relatively limited time window, meaning that those trees that are killed by sudden oak death will stand for a couple of years and then they will fall down. But if they're still standing, then the risk is definitely higher for a much hotter fire when you have oaks and tan oaks that are killed by the disease.
Professor, I live in Burbank. I've lived in the same house for a little over 20 years. I've had a big, beautiful oak tree in my front yard. Over the years, I have grown to love it. The tree helps shade the front of my house. I can save on air conditioning. Plus, it looks great. Can sudden oak death be combated? Is my oak tree in the middle of Burbank, is it in danger? What are the options there?
We should emphasize that there is so much that oaks do for humans. You know, they improve the quality of the water, they increase the level of shade, they provide recreational sites, they make sure that erosion doesn't happen. Now, given that these trees are so important, both ecologically and for humans in general, for these multiple services that they provide, definitely there has been a lot of research focused at identifying what we can do to control a disease like this. But the most important thing that we should mention is that the most important step in the fight to sudden death is early diagnosis of the disease. The earlier you identify the arrival of this exotic microbe in your neighborhood or your property, and the earlier you take action, the much greater the chances that whatever you do is going to be successful.
That's Matteo Garbellato. He's the director of the UC Berkeley Forest Pathology and Mycology Laboratory. Thank you very much for the time.
You're very welcome.
Now, you may have seen it as you drive on Sunset, just east of Highland, a building that kind of looks like an ocean liner surrounded by a little village of smaller structures. It's been there a long time, since the 30s, and many think it's America's first outdoor mall. Coming up, get to know Hollywood's crossroads of the world. That's next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's Thursday, so that means it's throwback time. So let's rewind the clock to some rich L.A. history.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Richard Che from Esoteric Tours is our guide to the past today. He's bringing us the story of Crossroads of the World, which many people say is America's first outdoor shopping mall. Richard, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, A.
All right. Crossroads of the World, first built in 1936. It's on the corner of Sunset and Las Palmas. Can you describe its design and look?
Yes, Robert Duras is the architect. It is a shopping mall built around a streamlined, modern cruise ship, and the surrounding buildings are all of different European themes, Spanish, English, Italian, in the front on Sunset around the ship, and in the back, Northern European, Russian, Scandinavian.
Yeah. And one of the things is when people drive past it, I think they notice something about it. But to see what you just said, you really got to stop and take a good look around at the place.
Yes, it is a streamlined modern cruise ship with a giant 8.5-foot rotating globe atop of this spire. The largest rotating globe in Los Angeles County beats the Los Angeles Times globe lobby by several feet.
Wow. All right. Now, so take us back, Richard, to when it first opened. What was it like? What could you find there at Crossroads of the World?
Crossroads of the World is best described as very akin to Farmer's Market or the Brentwood Country Mart today. It was a collection of small little retail spaces, cafes, haberdasheries, a barber shop. There was a very famous barber, the Barber of Seville, just up on the Sunset side. It was just this intimate space with little small pedestrian paths, the cottages, every style, Italianate, Cape Cod, Lithuanian, what have you. They all were designed by Duras to maximize retail space. So the Cape Cod cottages, which are just off of Las Palmas, they had these wonderful round windows for display. And so everything just draws you in. The walkways, the scale of the architecture, the plantings. It's fantastic. And it's has been really underused as a public space in the last several decades.
Yeah, it does invite you to walk through it, to stroll through it, to have just take a breath and just take a nice stroll. Why do you think it's been underused over the years?
Hollywood has really been through many reinventions, and the loss of the retail in Crossroads in the
80s, I think, even before, the loss of retail really turned it into just office space. And it just became, there was a famous recording studio there in the 70s and 80s. Production companies started moving their offices in there, and all of this is great. But just the bakeries, the haberdasheries, the barbershops, they all went away, and people stopped using it as a shortcut in Hollywood to get from one place to another.
We're talking about Crossroads of the World with Richard Shave from Esoteric Tours. Now, it had some secret crime roots, this place. Tell us about that.
Crossroads of the World is a memorial to the OG of Los Angeles crime, Charlie the Gray Wolf Crawford. Charlie's widow, Ella, built Crossroads of the World as a memorial to him. So it opens in 36. In May of 1931, Charlie Crawford, who is literally the guy that brought racketeering to Los Angeles at the turn of the 20th century, is sitting in his real estate office, which is on the site. Someone walks into his office, fatally shoots him.
Wow.
And his friend, Herbert Spencer, who's a publisher. Crawford is rushed to the hospital. He's wheeling him into the operating room to remove all the bullets. And they say, "Charlie, who shot you?" And he says, "I won't tell you." And he dies on the operating table. Mm. And so his widow says, he was changed his life. He'd reformed. He was going to start to do good. And we were going to spend our time traveling the world. So I want to build a mall in the shape of a cruise ship, because that's what he promised me we were going to do.
Oh, man. Wow. That's actually a pretty sweet story in a way.
It is. And to just sort of wrap it up, no one knows who killed Charlie Crawford. Dave Clark, who was a municipal judge, walked into the Hall of Justice 2 days later and said, "I did it." They put him on trial about 6 months later, mistrial, second trial, mistrial. So no one, it's one of these great unsolved mysteries of Los Angeles crime.
Love that, though. I love unsolved Hollywood mysteries. All right, now, thanks, Richard, for taking us through a history of Crossroads of the World. So let's bring it back to the present now. Where do things stand with it?
January of this year, City Council approved a redevelopment plan by Heritage Development Group to completely transform that space. The historic mall, which is not only on the National Register but a municipally recognized landmark, is going to be left relatively intact. And the block to the west of Los Palmas is basically going to be cleared, and they're going to put in a giant development. And then just to look across the street to Los Palmas, there are just a lot of concerns that this entire block of important buildings, which the city failed to recognize as historic, are going to be torn down. And there's just a lot of concern. And Hollywood is running out of space, so preservationists can't say, "Move these historic structures." Okay, you're going to take them down, let's move them. There's no more space. So I think as preservationists in Hollywood have sort of a bitter cup of coffee as they look ahead to how they can help save old buildings going forward.
It's Richard Shave with Esoteric Tours. He spoke with us about the history of Crossroads of the World, considered America's first outdoor shopping mall. Richard, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me, Abe.
Don't forget, we will have coverage of the shooting at Saugus High School all afternoon long here on 89.3 KPCC. If you missed any part of the show today, just head over to wherever you get your podcasts and look for us, Take Two. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.